what your feelings are about President Trump, the one thing that everybody can agree on is that he is certainly very different from his predecessors, and that he certainly isn't predictable. You know, senior staff in the White House that David and I talk to will often say they don't know where the president will come out on a given position until a final announcement's made. And even then, sometimes the announcement can change a few days later. So there is a lot of unpredictability. But if we look at the president's brief tenure in office and the events leading up to the 2016 presidential campaign, I think there are some lessons we can learn about his presidential style and his decision-making style. The first I would say is that while Trump's actions often appear to be very spontaneous and off the cuff, they are often very well calculated and planned. The second is that he is not really and never will be a part of the Republican Party and the party establishment. And third, his decision process, especially on big, high-profile issues, will always be very public and contain a lot of drama. So some examples of how the president's actions are a lot more calculated than they often appear. Many people may not know this, but President Trump first trademarked the phrase "Make America Great Again" in 2012, 6 days after President Obama was reelected. And while there had been some discussion in the news over the years that maybe Donald Trump would run for president, you know, people dismissed it as publicity stunts, but he was really planning his presidential campaign and already knew back in 2012 that "Make America Great Again" was going to be his slogan. He also contemplated a run for governor in 2012 for the governor of New York. And he had Kellyanne Conway and some familiar names that were advisors at the time, Steve Bannon and others, look into the issue. And Conway's polling and some other polling suggested that he might have actually been able to beat Andrew Cuomo for governor of New York, that New Yorkers had gone to that businessman establishment and electing Bloomberg to be mayor of New York City, and that there were other vulnerabilities. And ultimately, Donald Trump decided not to run for governor. Some of his advisors were telling him, you need to have public service and hold public office on your record before you can run for president. And a governor is often a stepping stone to the presidency. But Steve Bannon and Roger Stone, two of his advisors that we saw very prominently in the 2016 campaign, even back in 2012, were telling him, don't do it. One, if you lose, it would hurt your chances of running for president later. But more importantly, you would lose that outsider status, that I'm a businessman, I know how to correct things in the government and all the wrongs and all the inefficiencies. Once you're part of a government institution, you lose that outside appeal. And so back in 2012, Trump tweeted that he decided not to run for governor, but he foreshadowed a presidential run. He said, well, I will not be running for governor of New York, a race I would have won. I have much larger plans in mind. Stay tuned, will happen. So even back in 2012, when half of us didn't even know what Twitter was, he was tweeting, preparing for his presidential run. The other thing is around that time, he started to do a lot of Republican radio talk shows and other things. And he kept hearing about this sentiment against immigration and this disenfranchisement. And so he realized that whenever he talked about amnesty or the bill that the Senate was debating at the time, the Gang of Eight immigration bill, that his tweets got retweeted all over the place and a lot of likes, and he realized that there was just a lot of untapped enthusiasm out there for this anti-immigration, very populist message. And so in January 2015, he sat down with Steve Bannon and Roger Stone, two of his longtime advisors, and they said, why don't you throw out this trial idea? What do you think if we say we're going to build a wall on the border? So in an Iowa campaign event in January of 2015, Donald Trump threw out this trial balloon that he was going to build a wall. And when he got such great applause from the folks in attendance, he said, and he added spontaneously, and Donald Trump can build things, and I'm good at building things. And this became part of his campaign. But it wasn't at random. It was a very well thought out, calculated pillar that became part of his successful presidential run. The other tenet of Donald Trump is that he has never been and never will be a part of the Republican Party establishment. And I think that some of his actions clearly show this. You know, during the same time frame when immigration was coming to the forefront of the public policy debate around 2013, 2014, and Donald Trump started to recognize this disenfranchised voter, rather than going to some really big political rallies that some of the presidential candidates were doing, he started talking to a small grassroots group and go to these disenfranchised voters that really weren't particularly allegiant to either party, but that were disgusted with politics, that thought that, you know, Washington wasn't representing them, it was leaving them behind and not recognizing the struggles that they are facing every day in their lives. We also saw during election night events that, you know, the efforts of the president to bring Republican Party leaders into his campaign never really gelled. They were never really part of the Trump inner circle. So in Joshua Green's book, The Devil's Bargain, if you ever really want to get a good sense of the Trump White House and the decision making and all the events that led up to his successful campaign, he outlines the events of election night. And you know, prior to the election, right at the eve of the election, Ryan Priebus and Sean Spicer, you know, RNC officials, the chairman and top political spokesman for the RNC, really thought that the president was going to lose. They did not think that Donald Trump was going to win. And they started doing these quiet interviews with political reporters, very much defending Donald Trump, talking about his qualities, but also setting up, you know, some kind of mea culpa that if the president loses, if Donald Trump loses, it's not the fault of the RNC. Trying to make the case that the RNC did everything it possibly could to get the president elected. And those meetings, even though they were conducted quietly and in secret, got back to the president and his inner circle. And so they're never really, neither one of them was never really trusted within the administration. Other folks that seemed very close to the president during the campaign still had their challenges and their relationship difficulties with the president. For example, Chris Christie, you know, one of the president's most ardent supporters, on election night, when everyone was gathered in a room in Trump Tower with TVs and everything, kind of came in a very loud, bellous way that Donald Trump did not like and said, "Hey, I just heard from President Obama. And if you win, since he has my phone number, he's going to call me so I can hand the phone over to you and congratulate you." Well, Trump's reaction was some insanities followed by, you know, "Give him my number, you know, have him call me directly. I don't need you and your phone as a go-between," which showed that some of those relationships that we all thought were very strong were not necessarily as strong. We also saw during election night who Trump's inner circle really was. So the president didn't have a victory speech planned or a concession speech. A lot of times, political candidates will have both speeches written, and whichever one they'll give, whichever one they need once they know the results of the election. But Donald Trump was a little superstitious and never planned either a concession speech or a victory speech. So once it became clear that he truly won the election, he gathered in his Trump Tower penthouse with Steve Bannon, Steve Miller, top policy advisor and speechwriter who previously worked for Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, the now Attorney General, his daughter Ivanka, and his son-in-law Jared Kushner. And that's who wrote the speech that would show Donald Trump in his very first public appearance as the president-elect. Bannon, Spicer, some of those other advisors, Chris Christie, none of those people were part of that speech writing. And then finally, I think if we look at recent activities, we show that the president truly isn't part of the Republican Party. He made a recent deal with Democrats over the debt ceiling, has suggested a deal with Democrats over the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program, and, you know, in exchange for some additional funding for border security. Basically, he'll work with anyone he needs to get the job done, get what he feels was a campaign promise completed. He also saw that he couldn't get 51 votes on some key issues like healthcare and others when it came up on the floor. So he's going to get those votes no matter how he needs to do them. He's also expressed a willingness to endorse primary candidates against Republicans who don't necessarily vote the way that he thinks they should. And that's pretty unprecedented for a president to go against party leaders in his own Congress. So definitely, he's not your typical party establishment hack. He's not coordinating or working with Republicans in Congress the way other past presidents may have. And then finally, I would say that his decision-making process on many events is always very public and very dramatic. One of the first examples when he was president of this was in his announcement of Neil Gorsuch to be his nominee to the Supreme Court. He had a prime time, you know, press conference in which he asked them very grandiose way to come to the stage, Gorsuch and his wife, and made this big announcement. And then afterwards said, were you surprised? Were you surprised that he was my nominee? He also did a lot of campaigns with people that were speculated to be potential VP candidates and very publicly invited potential cabinet secretaries to Trump Tower for interviews and meetings, whereas some of his predecessors had a lot quieter, more discreet conversations with potential nominees. That's part of his very public vetting process that he does when he's looking at big decisions. Perhaps the greatest example of that is the recent activities on the climate accord and the decision to withdraw the Paris Climate Accords, which he announced in a Rose Garden ceremony. It was a campaign promise, but he also went through a decision-making process where he listened to all points of view, in many cases that reinforced his decision to withdraw, but it was a very public debate. So on one side, you had daughter Ivanka, who had reached out to many corporate CEOs and asked them to please lobby her dad to stay in the climate accord. And her activities ultimately resulted in a letter that was published in a Wall Street Journal ad to the president from many, many corporate executives urging that the United States stay within the climate accord. You also had Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urging the president not to withdraw from the accord, and National Economic Council Chief Gary Cohn. On the other side, you had Steve Bannon and Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator. And Bannon said the climate accord was the very essence of globalism and showing that America was being taken advantage by its allies. His position was supported by Scott Pruitt, who also threw in things about harming industry, the coal industry, and others. But one of the things where we saw the president's decision and him kind of hunker down on where he started in the campaign was a conversation with NEC Chief Gary Cohn. And he said, we have to look at all of these various industries and how their impact, what the impact of the withdrawing from the climate accord would be on these industries. And, you know, coal is only one part of our economy, and it's a small part, and it's a smart part that's not growing. But all these other industries, there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of growth, and we, by staying in the climate accord, we really have an opportunity to help grow the economy. Well, what the president heard in that conversation was coal. And he said, hey, you know, coal, those are the guys that supported me, that helped get me elected. I can't do anything that would harm coal. He also was lobbied pretty hard in a very public way at the G7 summit by world leaders, especially Angela Merkel and the new French President Macron. And, you know, that really didn't help get him to the place they wanted to be. In some cases, it backfired. He thought Macron was a little arrogant when he suggested that he needed to have a firm handshake to show that he's dealing with a strong leader when they met. And, you know, I think that backfired. And later we saw that in the president's statement in the Rose Garden when he said, we're going to stay in the Paris Climate Accord. He said, I'm here to represent the people of Pittsburgh, not Paris, which was a kind of direct dig at Macron after his efforts to lobby him to stay in the climate accord. I think we can continue to see this same public decision-making process as we look at the key pieces of legislation that will be debated in Congress for the rest of this year and for next year. So first of all, we're looking at a Christmas time showdown over spending and the debt ceiling. When the president worked with Democrats and came up with an agreement to extend the debt ceiling through December 8th, along with funding for Hurricane Harvey and Irma, and a continuing resolution to keep the government funded beyond October 1st, which is the start of the fiscal year, he set up this debate over Christmas. I think Republican Party leaders were concerned that it took away some leverage that they might have to make a deal later on taxes and other things, and they wanted a long-term debt ceiling extension. But that debate will replay itself again in the next few months, right, going into Christmas. The other very public, high, controversial issue that will be debated is DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and what to do with the so-called Dreamers. And, you know, at a recent meeting, the president met with Democratic leaders, and Democrats came out saying that they had a deal, that they were going to increase border security funding in exchange for passing DACA and giving legal status or even potentially citizenship to the Dreamers. The White House has walked away a little bit from the Democrats' proclamation of disagreement, but I think we'll see that play out certainly in the next several months in Congress. Healthcare is another big issue, and that's playing out right now. Republicans set up a budget procedure that allowed them to get only 51 votes in the Senate to pass health care, rather than the 60 that would be required generally to shut off a filibuster. But that authority, which came through a process called budget reconciliation, ends on September 30th. So right now, Senate leaders are looking at a new kind of revamped Lindsey Graham, Senator Cassidy bill that would to revive the healthcare debate, but we'll see if that can play out. Republicans are still gonna need 51 votes, and it's not sure that they can get the votes of the folks that they lost, like Senator Lisa Murkowski or from Alaska, or Susan Collins from Maine, or even potentially John McCain. When healthcare failed a few months ago, everyone said, oh, debate is now definitely going to turn to tax reform, and we can do tax reform. But the tax reform debate and the ability to cut taxes was also dependent in some ways on successfully passing health care and getting rid of costly health care subsidies in terms of looking at the federal budget and making sure that any tax cuts are offset with spending cuts, so the revenue losses would be offset. There seems to be some agreement this week in the Senate Budget Committee among Republican leaders to look at a $1.5 trillion tax cut, but how that plays out, you know, and what happens with the health care bill and the subsidies and the costs still remains to be seen. The same, I'd say, is true for infrastructure. That's one area where it seems like there could be a lot of bipartisan agreement. Everyone wants to invest in our infrastructure and create and improve our infrastructure. However, there were some savings that Congress was going to look to from the healthcare debate to help with infrastructure. We will see the administration in the next few weeks announce their plan for infrastructure improvements and see how this debate plays out. Another issue is the farm bill. I think we can expect to see a farm bill in early 2018. The House and Senate Agriculture Committees are now debating the farm bill, having hearings. There's no bill yet, but they're having a lot of hearings and taking a lot of input. And we're seeing some leaders in Congress also lay down their markers for what should be in the farm bill. I think generally there's a consensus that the farm bill will simply tweak the past farm bill rather than being a massive rewrite of farm and agricultural programs. But we are seeing some markers around the energy title. Senator Al Franken has put in a bill that would double the tax breaks and credits for energy, including the BCAP program, the Biomass Crop Assistance Program, which I know we've worked quite a bit with USDA to make sure that we maintained a stable supply of wood for our products. And then Congressman Biggs from Alabama, Republican from Alabama, has a program that would basically reduce and remove all those subsidies and funding for all the energy programs, including the BCAP program. So I think as we get closer to the 2018 elections, this is a pretty big slate of things on the Republican congressional agenda, and it will remain to be seen how they will play out, what the president's popularity will be, how he'll be dealing with the Republican leaders in Congress as well as the Democratic leaders in Congress. I do think that we will continue to see reforms at the regulatory level. I'm very pro-business reforms. For example, EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are currently taking comments on repealing the Waters of the U.S. rule, a campaign promise of the president. And the Waters of the U.S. rule was very concerning to many in industry, from agriculture to real estate developers, to shopping center developers, to states and localities, because it would have greatly expanded the cost of water regulation and the scope of water subject to federal regulation and permitting. EPA and the Corps are now looking at what should replace that, what should come next, so that we make sure we have clarity around what's the definition of waters of the U.S. And we're seeing similar efforts on other regulatory issues, such as overtime regulations or issues dealing with the National Labor Relations Board. But the 2018 midterm elections are looming, and midterm elections are generally a referendum on the sitting president. Currently, there's 52 Republicans in the Senate and 48 Democrats, but 34 of those seats are up for re-election in 2018. 25 of them are held by Democrats. So the math for Democrats to take over the Senate in 2018 is not good, simply by sheer numbers. Larry Sabato with the University of Virginia is one of the great political commentators, and he said only 16 House seats are actually competitive. Currently, Republicans have 240 seats in the House of Representatives. They need 218 for a simple majority to pass most bills. We've also seen some midterm elections, special elections, to replace President Trump's cabinet nominees, and Republicans have won in those seats, regardless of the president's, low national approval ratings. So it's hard to say what is in store for the 2018 elections. Conventional wisdom says not much change. The polling site 538, which has great polling and political predictions going into the election, said that even if Democrats win in 2018, Senate races for all the places that Hillary Clinton won or that president won by less than 3 points during the presidential election, they could still stand to lose 5 Senate seats in 2018. So things are not looking good for a Democratic takeover of Congress in 2018. But I think the one thing we learned from the 2016 presidential election is, despite polls and conventional wisdom, nothing is truly predictable. And nobody really knows what's going to happen. So with that, I'm going to pause now so we can take some questions. I want to allow plenty of time for questions.
Do we have any questions? No, John?
I'll ask you a question. Get everybody here.
Well, I'll repeat your question.
The administrative agencies, such as the EPA, do you have any opinion on whether or not they're going to be able to roll back everything that was done by administrative fiat rather than legislation? In other words, is it as far as Trump said he was going to take it? I mean, there are some very encouraging signs at EPA and also the Department of Education, but is that going to be as effective as Trump said it was going to be?
Okay, the question is, regarding all the administrative agencies, EPA and the others, education, what's the probability that Trump's going to be able to roll back all of the legislative fiats that were done by, or the presidential fiats that were done by Obama?
Okay, so The president on Election Day actually signed a lot of executive orders to undo a lot of presidential Obama's executive orders. Those can easily be undone. So, for example, with the water regulation, he signed an executive order stating that the WOTUS rule, the Waters of the U.S. rule, would hurt the national economy, and that getting rid of it and replacing it with a common sense approach to water regulation was in the national economic interest. We saw a lot of those types of things, and I think in the agency process, you're seeing a lot of looking at regulatory reform, looking at things that can be done administratively, slowing down the implementation of some Obama regulations related to pesticide regulation and worker protection or other things. But there are some things that legislatively, if it has to be done legislatively, that's the big challenge. So the things that have to go through the Environment and Public Works Committee in the Senate, for example, it's a very polarized committee. And there is no desire to do anything, even things that in the past may have seemed bipartisan, if it looks like it's something that the Trump EPA would support. So, you know, big ticket items like massive legislative reform of the Endangered Species Act or the Clean Air Act that require congressional approval, I wouldn't count on those things happening. But administrative tweaks to some of these programs, I think those are very real conversations that are happening right now in the administration that we can see. Now, I will say that there are still a lot of vacancies in most of the federal agencies, which is slowing down that process. And in some cases, I think that the White House has decided that they don't need a ton of political appointees. They don't need to add more to the federal bureaucracy. And I predict that some of those positions just won't be filled. But certainly at the assistant administrator level, you know, the heads of the Office of Water or the Office of Chemical Safety or the Office of Air and Radiation, those nominations we're just starting to see. There's confirmation hearings that were supposed to happen today for some of those assistant administrators. It got postponed because of the congressional schedule. But they'll be rescheduled soon. But until those sub-cabinet appointments are really confirmed by the U.S. Senate, you're going to have some delays in moving forward on some of these administrative rulemaking processes.
Did that answer your question, John?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? You said earlier that there was an effort by Briggs to propose a rollback on the subsidies for environment that were done mostly by fiat under the Obama administration, including BCAP. What do you think the probability of that moving forward is?
Well, BCAP was established in the Farm Bill, and I don't see the probability that we're going to completely eliminate an energy title from the Farm Bill. But that debate is just starting now. I think you could see some decreased funding for some of these programs or some less emphasis on some of these types of things, but I don't predict that the entire energy title of the Farm Bill or the BCAP or those programs will totally go away. But it's pretty early to tell right now in this debate. The 2018 Farm Bill probably won't be drafted until early next year, and then we'll get a sense of it, and we certainly want to make sure that we work with all of our members to address these issues as that Farm Bill debate proceeds.
But in the 2008 Farm Bill, BCAP was actually eliminated until the third round vote.
Right. Things keep changing, and they will change until they're done. And I don't think the Farm Bill, while it will probably be a tweak of current farm programs, it's not going to be a simple thing. I think there's going to be fights over spending on various subsidies, the energy subsidies, but certainly also things like the level of funding for the SNAP program, which is the food stamp program, and other things. That's going to be pretty hotly debated. And, you know, it could take a couple of rounds to get a Farm Bill the way it did last year. So we will be very closely engaged and monitor and keep all of our members incredibly updated on where BCAP and other energy programs and these subsidies stand as the debate moves forward.
How much pushback is Administrator Pruitt going to have from internal forces? Is he going to be able to streamline the EPA as they had hoped to do, or is that really not doable?
I think he will be able to streamline some decision-making process, you know, get back to a little more rigorous scientific analysis or some of those things. But I don't think that the administration will be able to, you know, have the mass layoffs of EPA employees that have been discussed. While there are certainly Republican proponents of, you know, abolishing the EPA or drastically cutting their funding, you know, there's also a lot of interest in maintaining many programs, and that I don't think we're going to have the drastic budget cuts to EPA. There definitely will be budget cuts, and they'll be significant, but probably not to the level that is requested in the president's budget.
Any questions?
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about the infrastructure push. How does that fit into ACA reform and anything else, tax reform?
There's been a lot of talk about infrastructure, and how does that fit into ACA reform and tax reform?
Sure. So the ACA, when Congress negotiated their budget deal last year, they put in something in the budget reconciliation process, special procedures that said you needed 51 votes to pass the ACA in the Senate rather than 60. But it also constrained what could be done in the context of reforming the ACA. And sort of the strategy of the time was you get rid of the mandate and then you get rid of all these subsidies for health insurance, the U.S. Treasury saves a lot of money. And that savings could then later be put towards tax reform and tax cuts and also towards infrastructure spending. If we don't get a health care bill by September 30th, that special budget reconciliation authority expires. And the thinking was for the 2018 budget process that that same authority, rather than granting it to healthcare, would be granted towards tax reform. But we don't know how that will turn out until we see how the healthcare debate plays out just over the next 2 weeks. It will certainly make it harder without those healthcare savings to do tax reform. And I think tax reform is definitely going to be a lot harder than it seems. There are a lot of competing interests. A lot of some folks who really want to look at the America First and have border adjustment tariffs on, you know, ingredients that may be used in product development, taxing those if they're not here in the U.S., and equal pushback against that kind of border adjustment tax. There's a general sense in the Senate to support a $1.5 trillion tax cut as part of tax deals, but not real firm things on how they're going to get to the savings to get to that $1.5 trillion, especially if they don't have the savings from the healthcare subsidies. And I think the same is true with spending on infrastructure. But if I had a bet on one of those two being able to move, I think infrastructure is the area that's a lot less controversial. There's also going to be a lot more discussion about infrastructure in the wake of all the hurricanes we've had. The president just signed into law, after Congress passed pretty quickly, the Hurricane Harvey relief that also anticipated some relief for Hurricane Irma. But we've got more hurricanes, and we're hearing today about Hurricane Maria and the impacts on Puerto Rico, but also the impacts on infrastructure. And so I think that if I had to put my money behind one of those as being the thing that maybe we could get that bipartisan agreement, it would be infrastructure over tax reform.
Any other questions? Well, Lori, I thank you for your presentation. We're running a little ahead of schedule, so let me ask.
We have an update on David's knee.
Oh, they're asking for an update on David's knee.
Oh, thanks.
You have to realize that David is he's a marathon runner.
He is, although you know, knowing that he's had such problems with his knee and was going to have his knee replaced, he started bike riding. So he's actually been riding, even until the day before surgery, 25 miles each way to work every day, and swears once this is over, he's doing a 100-mile bike ride, and he's planned to do it. But right now, he's in the pain management phase of the surgery, because knee replacement surgery requires cutting through bone, and it's a pretty painful process. So he'll be great, but right now he's doped up on a lot of pain medication, which is why he couldn't do this presentation himself. And really, I know he really will appreciate hearing all of your well wishes and concerns, so thanks for that.
We do wish him well. Any other questions?
When David told us last year that Trump had a chance in the election, did he really mean it?
When David told us last year that Trump had a chance at the election, did he really mean it?
I think that David was just as surprised on election night as all of us. There were certainly factors working against Hillary Clinton, and you know, the Steve Bannon machine was laying out the case against Hillary Clinton well before kind of got hooked up with Donald Trump and his stuff, but nobody really predicted in D.C. that Donald Trump was going to be the next president. And if they said they predicted that election night would have turned out the way they said it, the way it actually did, I think they're lying.
I did talk to David, and he says, anybody who tells you they know what's going to happen next week in Washington with certainty is also lying. Because there is no
certainty. Please take that in mind and don't hold me to anything I said about how the next, you know, 18 months will play out in Congress, because, again, I think everything is unpredictable.
Does Trump think he's behind on these things, or does he think he has time in 4 years to get his agenda to the point that maybe he can get reelected, or...
Oh, I think he's already very much planning his reelection. We've seen a lot of campaign events, which is pretty early to be holding campaign events into his tenure. But I think there's definitely frustration with the pace of change, and especially on the healthcare debate and tax reform. But to say I have inside knowledge, again, I think nobody really knows what's inside the president's head, but we can read his tweets, and his tweets show that a lot of frustration, I think, with the pace of change.
What about the ongoing relationship with the media?
I'm sorry, the ongoing relationship with who?
The media.
Oh, I think that, you know, making the media, you know, kind of this fourth pillar of government and a point to attack and discredit, I think that that will continue very much. You know, the president really understands the media and how to play it. He also really worked in his campaign with Steve Bannon to really come up with these alternative sources of news and ways to discredit Hillary Clinton. I think that stuff will continue. I think he relishes the fight with the media in the very public, you know, denouncing of the New York Times and things. I think he relishes that. I think it plays very well to his base. And I'd go back to the kind of the earlier comments I made about things being very calculated. I think it's very calculated that he attacks things that are seen as stuffy old institutions like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or CNN. I think that plays very well with kind of those disenfranchised voters that really got behind him, and he's going to keep playing that game, so, and showing them that he's with them.
I've noticed my lunch period is spent listening to the White House press conference meetings, and the nature of the questions that the press asks from the beginning to now, they're much less antagonistic in, say, the last 3 weeks than they have been prior, where their questions were fairly loaded and had an agenda, but they were met with pushback from the White House.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that, you know, there has been some pushback and or some willingness to be a little more conciliatory, seeing that he cut a deal with Democrats and worked with Democrats to get the debt ceiling deal done. His approval ratings has gone up a little bit, but ultimately he relishes that fight. I think we're going to continue to see it, and I don't think he walks away from those things. I also think that the media is trying to figure out how they handle the president. So, you know, it used to be you had a White House correspondent, and they were very much on the ground, flying on Air Force One, following the president around, and being able to give you news as it was happening. But now they don't know how to handle a president who's making all his announcements by Twitter. He's creating the news. He is the news. It's not his actions aren't being reported on. He's reporting on them himself. And I think the media is trying to figure out how to react to this new normal of a president who doesn't go to the media to make his announcements, but does it on his own.
Is his recent deal with the Democrats on the Harvey bill, the funding, which is what he wanted, and he more or less agreed, gave the Democrats a bone, moving the debt ceiling back 3 months instead of 18 months as his own party wanted. Was that kind of a shot over the bow for the Republicans?
Oh, I think so. I think Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan were very surprised by the deal. I think they were not happy with the deal. I think that Republicans feel like it took away leverage for them on some of the tax, the kind of upcoming debate on tax reform. It also hurt Republicans with dealing within their own caucus with the Freedom Caucus and really kind of the austerity type Republicans who want to cut all government spending and everything. And they've traditionally looked at the debt ceiling as a way to get something, and they feel like it kind of cut out that opportunity to get something. So it was very much a shot across the bow at Republicans and the establishment. And then the same thing happened to a lesser degree with less specificity just last week when the president met with Democrats to talk about DACA and how DACA could be paired with some border security funding. And that was a meeting with Democratic leaders, not Republican leaders. So it's certainly playing out to be very interesting to see who he's going to work with in these debates, what his relationship will be at the end of the day with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. I don't know, but it's certainly unfolding right before our eyes.
Any questions for Lori?
Yeah.
Yes. Go ahead.
Will Trump reaching out to the Democratic leadership put a wedge between the resistance and the left has, and how significant is that resistance?
Will the Trump reaching out to the Democrats put a wedge between the resistance and the White House?
And the Democratic
Party. And the Democratic Party? And how significant is that resistance?
Well, I think the folks that think that Donald Trump is like evil incarnate are not going to change their minds even if he's working with Democrats. And I think the folks that really are so disenfranchised politically on both ends of the spectrum with the Bernie Sanders voters or the far right on the Republican side, they don't like this deals with Democrats and all of that. That disenfranchisement, that resistance is not going to go away. But the question is, can Democrats really, is a progressive message, is going to the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren front going to save them? Or is it showing that they can work and get things done and work with the president on things like DACA going to save the day? I don't know. I mean, Democrats' unfavorability rating in Congress and Republicans they're all just as unpopular as the president. Nobody seems to be very popular. But I would say that the president still is very popular in the counties that he feels got him elected. So when you look at those counties in places like Michigan or Pennsylvania or Ohio or Florida, those folks, he still has the support of the folks that feel like he was speaking for them, that nobody in Washington, Democrat or Republican, was looking out for their interests or the fact that they've lost all these manufacturing jobs. He still has all that support right now.
Chris, you had a question?
Yeah. Is it better or worse with North Korea emerging as a nuclear power to have Trump in office or not?
Is it better or worse with North Korea emerging as a nuclear power to have Trump in office or not?
I don't know. I don't know how that situation plays out. I know that right now we have two people that have a lot of rhetoric and bad hair that are having this fight. But, you know, there was a lot of tweets about, you know, his chief of staff, General Kelly, going like this and looking, shaking his head when he called, you know, the president of North Korea Rocket Man. But that's one of those tough situations that I don't know what the right policy options are or how that plays out, because we have to look it out for, you know, South Korea. We've got to look out for our troops at the DMZ. And I think that there are a lot of people in the government really looking at that question pretty closely, and we'll see. I'm certainly not a foreign policy expert.
Well, if he could fire a missile to the east, he could also fire it to the west. I'm curious why that's not a major concern.
Oh, I think it's a major concern, and I think we'll be hearing more about it following his UN speech yesterday. I think that will be one of the main topics on a lot of the Sunday talk shows.
I didn't get a chance to hear his UN speech. Do you know what the reaction to it was?
It was very, very strident. His speech, you know, calling the president Rocket Man, saying, "We'll not stand, we'll obliterate you." I think there was a lot of concern from, you know, some of our allies about that strong language, but I don't know. I don't know how you deal with an irrational guy like the leader of North Korea, so I don't know what works. Maybe the president and his security team have some more insight than I do, and I think there's certainly people who say it's horrible. He is actually going to get us to war in Korea, and we're just setting up this horrible disaster. And other people are saying, well, maybe he needs to be dealt with that harsh way. So I don't know.
What is your anticipation of the midterm elections? It will be non-incumbent, non-political swing, RuPaul.
What's your expectations for the midterm elections regarding incumbents, non-incumbents, any swings, or who's going to fall?
You know, conventional wisdom says that the president's approval ratings are pretty low nationally, and that the midterm election is generally a referendum on the sitting president. But that being said, there are, you know, district lines are drawn in ways that there's not a lot of competitive seats in the House. A lot of the seats at risk in the Senate are Democratic seats. So I don't see big changes. I will say that if Democrats were to take control of Congress, I think you'd immediately have impeachment hearings and a lot more focus on the Russia investigation and others. But if you look at the competitive races, they're not in places where President Trump is particularly vulnerable or particularly disliked. And, you know, the seats that are up in the Senate especially tend to favor Republicans holding their majority in the Senate.
Is it possible they would achieve a supermajority? Could they hold 60?
Right. So Republicans currently hold 52 seats. You know, if you say that the Democrats lose 5 seats, you know, that's still not getting us to 60. They could increase their majority, but it's also fairly not unprecedented, and it happened, and we saw it in George W. Bush's re-election, where the majorities in Congress increased, but generally that's not happened. But I'd say with this whole election, all kind of typical rules of looking at polling and what's going to happen and predictions are out the window.
There was another question back in the back. Byron?
Would you ask if the EPA is on track to take down 2 regulations that are reviewing the implement?
Is the EPA on track to take out 2 regulations for every 1 they implement?
So, you know, there's not been clear guidance yet on how you do that, how you approach removing 2 regulations for every 1 regulation. There seems to have been in the administration over the last few months less emphasis on that proclamation and more about getting rid of things or delaying things. I don't think we will get rid of, if you look at the water example, we're getting rid of 1 regulation, but it's taking 2 regulations to actually do it. 1 regulation to rescind the water rule, and then a 2nd regulation to create a new water rule. So that certainly doesn't follow the, you know, 2-for-1 pattern. It's sort of the opposite. There is definitely an emphasis on looking at regulations that can be eliminated. And there's been a very public process that the EPA undertook and USDA and all the various federal agencies over the last few months of selecting comments on regulations that people think should be eliminated because they're useless or burdensome. And I had hundreds and thousands and thousands of comments on all of these issues, on what regulations should stand or shouldn't stand. And I think that, you know, all the cabinet departments and the EPA are starting to kind of look at those comments, and you'll see some proposals, I think, for eliminating regulations in the next few months based on that public feedback. But it's being done, and I think this is something that the administration is doing in a smart way, putting out formal notices for public comments on these things, holding, you know, these public stakeholder meetings. They want to very much show, and this is something that Scott Pruitt, as the former attorney general, knows very well, that they are following policies and procedures. One of the criticisms from, you know, Republicans like Scott Pruitt and others has been that when they implemented a lot of these regulations, that President Obama didn't follow administrative procedures and tried to circumvent them. So in this effort to remove regulations, I think the administration is being very deliberative and careful to show that they are following all of those administrative procedures. And I think that's why the pace of a lot of that activities is slower than people would expect, is because it's being done in a very careful and deliberative way. Also, on some of these decisions, you don't have those sub-cabinet nominees confirmed yet, and you have career staff that are not going to make decisions about some of those things until they have a political boss to help with that decision-making process.
But you think they will strike the WOTUS rule?
Oh, the WOTUS rule is definitely gone. So there's a formal comment period right now that closes at the end of the month to rescind the WOTUS rule and put in place the prior regulations that were on the books after various Supreme Court cases. And then the administration has said we're going to do a second process to look at what should replace the status quo, what's really been in place since a federal court put a stay on the implementation of the WOTUS rule. That, what comes next, the administration's now going through a series of stakeholder meetings. They've got, you know, for example, a mining meeting, an agriculture meeting to solicit public comment on what comes next. And there'll be a formal written process to accept public comments on what should replace the WOTUS rule. But the process of repealing it is well underway. I think once you get the public comment period that closes at the end of the month on rescinding the WOTUS rule, again, the administration will have to go through those time-consuming process of responding to public comments, reviewing and analyzing all those public comments. But then very soon after that process is done, the WOTUS rule will be rescinded and replaced with kind of the status quo. And then that phase two process is already starting on what comes next in terms of WOTUS.
John.
I just had a question. In regard to the president's popularity during the period of the midterm election, does it really matter that much since on the day he got elected, Donald Trump's disapproval rate was about 60%?
Does it matter what his popularity is during the midterm elections, given the fact that his popularity was statistically low during the national election?
I'd say not as much as conventional wisdom would say it does matter, because his popularity is still high in the places where he won, which are considered those swing states, or you know, places like Ohio and Michigan. And really, when you look at the midterm elections, you have to look at the seats that are vulnerable, that are considered toss-up seats, and they're not in places where president has really low approval ratings. In many cases, he has some high approval ratings in some of those places.
How vulnerable do you think Jeff Flake is?
Hard to say. I mean, I really like Jeff Flake. I think he's one of those guys that will continue to work and try to push some moderate agenda, but he has certainly got the ire of President Trump, and that will definitely hurt him. I mean, he really could be very vulnerable, but, you know, in the last McCain election, everyone thought McCain was done for because he'd been soft on immigration and looking at, you know, the Gang of Eight bill and other things, and he pulled it through. So we'll see how things play out going into the elections, but he's certainly one of those seats that you know, the president has made no bones about his disputes with Jeff Flake, and, you know, the president still remains pretty popular in parts of Arizona.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
What's the chances that Trump possibly nominates another one or two Supreme Court justices before 2020?
What are the chances that Trump gets a shot at nominating one or two other Supreme Court justices before 2020?
Well, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's pretty old and getting up there. I mean, I think that there's a good shot. I mean, I think if you look at her, she will hang on as long as she can to try to outlast Donald Trump's presidency. But, but you know, health, we've got aging Supreme Court justices with health issues and all those other things. And if we're looking at 8 years versus 4 years, then that likelihood is certainly higher. But I think I would definitely bank on probably having a second Donald Trump nominee over the next 4 or 8 years, depending on how his election, re-election bid pans out.
She'll hang on as long as she can.
I think she will.
Any other questions? Lori, I thank you for your time and your expertise. I've enjoyed your presentation, and I'm amazed that all this technology actually worked the entire time.
Well, I think some of the technology stuff's a first for me, too, and I really appreciate everyone's time and willingness to just look at my head on a big monitor, which has got to be hard. So thanks for putting up with that and with me, and I appreciate everything and hope the rest of the meeting goes really well.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Shelley, we have a break?
Yeah, back to 3.
Back at 3 o'clock. Oh, we got to turn it off.